of our listeners. I'm your host, Scott Nelson, for WGTD. Thanks for listening.
This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, vice president for community and government relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Today, we have a returning guest who is making another appearance on Education Matters. Dr. Andrew Salt is an associate professor of educational policy and the interim dean of the College of Education at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. Dr. Salt has been a guest of Education Matters twice before, in 2017, just as the first Trump administration started, and again in 2021, just as the Biden administration was getting underway. Both of those programs are available in our archives and will be linked in our show notes and on the Education Matters Facebook page. A quick way to find these interviews is to search the WGTD webpage with his last name, S-A-U-L-T-Z. Welcome back, Dr. Salt.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So Dr. Salt studies educational accountability, federal education policy, and the intersection between health and education policy. He started his career as a high school social studies teacher and served on his local school board in Michigan during the Great Recession. Dr. Salt earned a BA in political science from Oregon State University, an MAT in social studies from Lewis and Clark, and a PhD in educational policy from Michigan State University. He lives in Portland, Oregon, in the neighborhood he grew up in with his wife and two sons, and enjoys reading and exploring the outdoors. And also, how long did you spend in Ohio, Dr. Salt?
Yeah, we lived in Ohio for a number of years where I worked as an assistant professor at Miami University in Oxford.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to make sure that you get your Midwestern cred because you've spent over a decade in Michigan and Ohio. Now, maybe some people, because they're in the Eastern time zone, don't consider them Midwestern, but I just wanted to make sure people understood that you do have a grasp on what's going on in the heartland.
Absolutely. Yeah, so 5 years in Michigan and 7 in Ohio, so 12 years
okay.
in the West. I think that
yeah.
qualifies.
I think that qualifies, too. So today, Dr. Salt will give us an overview of federal education policy. He'll be updating us on what has happened with federal education policy during the past 4 years and look ahead to the next four. So as we did the last time you visited us, I'd like to ask you to give a bit of overview on what the role the federal government actually plays in education in the United States, because really much of the action is happening at the local and state level. So what do the feds do, for how long have they been involved, and why?
Yeah, great question, and thanks again for having me on here. It was fun to think back to 2017 and 2021 being on this show, and that feels like so long ago and so much has changed. And yet, as we think about the federal role in education policy, that has remained pretty constant since the 1960s. And we look at the Lyndon Johnson administration as really starting to increase the federal role in 1965 with the Elementary, Secondary, and Education Act, which centered students living in poverty and saw the federal government's role as improving outcomes and really increasing funding for schools that taught high percentages of students living in poverty. Another thing I want to just emphasize on the front end, in the 1970s, the federal government really centered students with disabilities really created a national dialogue about how to better serve our students with disabilities. And so the federal government has had an important role, both in terms of protecting what public education means for all students and funding special education specifically. The third big time point for the federal government and shift is really under the George W. Bush administration. And in 2001, a lot of our listeners will know about No Child Left Behind, which was a bipartisan effort led by President Bush to increase educational accountability through standardized testing, particularly in reading and math. So big picture, as we think about the federal government, they fund special education, they fund programs for students living in poverty, things like school lunches, and also some teacher training programs. But the majority of funding, as you said, and policy comes from the local and state level.
Okay. So the last time we spoke, you told us that the federal government spends only about 6% of its discretionary budget, which is only 29% of the total federal budget. So it is a pretty small percentage of the total federal budget. Did that change at all under President Biden?
Yeah, as I was reflecting on the last 4 years with President Biden and his administration, you know, 2020 into 2021, we were so immersed in COVID and COVID response. And that was true for education policy as well. The major funding that came out of the Biden administration was called the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund, or ESSER. That was $190 billion with a B. And much of that money was used to backfill things like staffing, pay for things like COVID tests and masking and other protections for schools, and to backfill state government budgets, which were really struggling under COVID because the economy struggled. And so those funds were passed in kind of 2021 and had to be spent by 2024. So you might think about the whole range of the administration being impacted by the ESSER funds. In terms of outside of the COVID relief funds, the budget did not significantly change under President Biden. He did have a number of efforts around teacher training, teacher pay, but those were really on the margins. And so the vast majority of funding still comes from the state and local level.
Okay. And we talked about, last time we talked about what President Trump's goals were in his first term and which of them were accomplished. So we are doing the same here. What were Biden's goals and which of them were accomplished?
Yeah, great question. And we'll talk about this a little bit as we get to the second Trump administration, because there's been a little bit of a pendulum. And under the first Trump administration, there was a redefinition of discrimination based on race, based on gender, and a rollback for protections for LGBT students specifically in what's known as the Office of Civil Rights, or OCR, under the U.S. Department of Education. Part of Biden's goals were to shift back to how President Obama had defined that discrimination. And so that was a goal under the Biden administration, and they accomplished that shift of redefining discrimination. As you may anticipate, the Trump administration second go-around is looking to redefine discrimination once again. So we'll talk more about that. But that was, I think, a central part of President Biden's vision of what the U.S. Department of Education should be, and that is, you know, addressing discrimination as it comes up based on race or class or gender or sexual orientation. Two other things that President Biden really set as goals. One was to support teachers generally with a whole series of professional development programs. There was a lot of talk around increasing teacher pay. And the federal level, the federal government really doesn't have a specific role in that. So that was more using the bully pulpit to get the message out. And then the last thing, I mean, I do think President Biden wanted to stabilize school budgets. And as you might imagine, $190 billion spread across 50 states allowed schools to retain staff specifically, and some technology, some student mental health support, which we saw a rise for. The need to address student mental health during COVID. So those were all embedded within those ESSER funds. But in general, I think he met the goal of trying to stabilize budgets and prevent kind of massive layoffs for teachers.
Mm-hmm. One thing that got a lot of coverage under Biden was student loan forgiveness. How much was actually forgiven? And is any of that sticky? Is there any way that loan forgiveness might be reversed?
Yeah, and this is, you know, the last month it has come, a lot of ed policy has changed really rapidly. And so the Trump administration has said they want to shift how student loans work. and oppose some of the student loan forgiveness stuff that President Biden was trying to do. I haven't seen a total amount. I do know that some of the websites are down now, so people are not able to access things. And some of this is caught in the courts in terms of what can and cannot be done. So this is a challenging part. And again, maybe one other example of how the Trump administration, the Biden administration really differed kind of night and day in terms of how they thought the country should move forward.
Right. So this brings us to President Trump's agenda the second time around. So first off, this is what we did with the other two programs. What do you think of his choice for Education Secretary Linda McMahon?
Yeah, I was not familiar with Linda McMahon prior to the announcement that she was going to be his nominee. I did have a chance to watch some of the confirmation hearings. I think, you know, as Linda McMahon talks about her vision for ed policy of the federal government, it's very much in line with what President Trump said during the campaign. She believes in school choice. She believes in reducing the federal role and allowing states and localities a lot of discretion in terms of what they want to do. And she has kind of stated many of the things that go back to kind of Betsy DeVos's vision of ed policy as well.
Yeah, I caught a little bit of the hearings, not a lot, but I mean, she was pretty consistent, that I have to say. So whether you agree with her or not, you know, it was a pretty clear vision. So we've probably all heard by now that a major goal for education under the Trump administration is to entirely eliminate the Department of Education. Most of what I've read about this indicates that it's easier said than done, but given the path that the DOGE effort has kind of been plowing through the federal government, maybe they can eliminate it completely. What do you see as the pros and cons of this effort, as well as the odds of it actually succeeding?
Yeah, well, and it does feel as though some of these efforts are pushing legal boundaries. And so one question is, does the executive branch have the right or authority to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education? My understanding is that would take an act of Congress, and that would need to go through the budgeting process. My understanding, if you look at the plan specifically, when we hear eliminate U.S. Department of Ed, I think they want to redistribute some of the functions to other areas. So while the Trump administration has been pretty clear that they don't like things like student loan forgiveness, they want to limit school lunches and programs for students living in poverty, I would be shocked if there wasn't, you know, something around students with disabilities that still existed, right? And so you could imagine that going to a different department. I think Congress right now, it feels to me politically, is trying to decide what they want / can push back on an executive branch that has a pretty strong voice and strong vision. I think personally it would be a really politically tough sell, even for the Trump administration, to get Congress to approve an elimination of the Department of Education, just because so much of that money goes to rural communities that are deep red. And so I think there would have to be a lot of assurances about what happens to some of those schools if funding, particularly for schools serving students living in poverty, for example, what would happen then. So can they eliminate it? With Congress, I think they legally could. Without Congress, I think it would get caught in the courts. But politically, I think this is going to be a tough sell, even in the GOP.
Yeah, when I've talked to people about this and explained that special education is such a huge part of the federal role, I think they have not met special education parents, advocates, and lawyers, if they think that they can eliminate that, because that is one of the best organized and most powerful lobbies, I would say, even though, you know, they're not they're not a lobby that's trying to deregulate themselves. They're a lobby that's trying to keep in place the supports that their children need. And, you know, I wouldn't cross them myself.
Yeah, and that's an important point for our listeners, that in terms of interest groups within education, nationally and at the state level, special education as an interest group has a lot of parents, like you said, has a lot of lawyers that understand mm-hmm. this well, and it will be a tough group to move away from providing the supports that they fought really hard for over the last, you know, 50 years.
Right. I'm just going to take a reintroduction break. You are listening to WGTDHDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of federal education policy with expert Dr. Andrew Salt of Pacific University is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So are there any initiatives that Trump wants to pursue other than eliminating the federal role in education entirely? Are there certain things that where he'd actually like to put some money and some federal muscle?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's three kind of big things that we have not talked about yet. The first is the Trump administration and Linda McMahon specifically have talked about vouchers, which is using public money to pay for private school tuition, or, you know, really giving in some kind of examples of vouchers, families can use the money the state would set aside for a child to be educated in any way they want. So they could take that to a public school, they could take that to a charter school, they could take that to a private school, or in some cases could keep the money for homeschooling. One kind of observation, as I've listened to some of the discussion around federal education policy coming out of this administration, it feels to me like they want individual parents making more decisions, and they want accountability to be in the hands of parents. That is, if parents are happy with schools, the schools will continue to thrive. If parents aren't happy, they can, you know, very quickly and easily take that money and go elsewhere. We've seen this in a number of states, particularly red states, and the research is pretty clear that the vast majority of vouchers are used by individuals who were already using private schools before the voucher program. Mm-hmm. The second kind of big initiative, and this came out recently, the Trump administration talks a lot about schools as institutions that talk too much about diversity, equity, inclusion, that are, you know, not focused on the, quote, core or traditional curriculum of reading, math, et cetera. And so they actually announced a whistleblowing website. And the idea is, if parents or students in some cases hear about schools talking about everything from LGBT issues to in some circumstances, sexual education and components of that that differ from the Trump administration's view of those things, that they could report, and then schools could potentially get in trouble for things that were said or things that were given to students around curricular issues. So this is a new development, but goes in line with the administration's belief that schools have drifted from the traditional kind of reading and math, and have accepted this DEI premise that is not good for students. Again, this is a Trump administration saying this. I have not seen a whistleblowing website of that scale nationally, and I'm curious to see how that plays out. The last thing, and this actually relates to something I said earlier about parents as like the mechanism of accountability. The Trump administration has announced that they are getting rid of the National Assessment of Education Progress, which is a test that has gone back over 50 years now. It's a national test. It's low stakes, but it has been used to measure kind of how the country is doing. It's been called the nation's report card, for example. It feels to me like this administration is moving away from standardized testing as a primary mechanism for accountability. And so there's just a lot less emphasis, and I'm comparing it specifically to the George W. Bush administration, but the last few Republican presidents specifically have had this notion of, we need to test and measure report those results, and that is going to lead to school improvement and ultimately more student learning. It feels to me like, and certainly the discussion from Linda McMahon as the Secretary of Education, that testing and standardized testing is way less emphasized than other Republican administrations and certainly Republican candidates in the past have talked about. So it's kind of an interesting trend. I'm interested to see how it develops, but getting rid of the NAEP is certainly a movement away from the standardized testing as a way of talking about school quality.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they are not a perfect instrument for measuring either school quality or student learning for a lot of reasons. I'm sure if listeners are listening to this, they'll think back to their own standardized test days and wonder whether they were a great indicator for them. So that's interesting. The one thing that it does do is it makes it hard to measure over time what's happened, but there may be other ways. So
yeah, well, and it does seem like standardized tests, I mean, I mentioned No Child Left Behind as this bipartisan bill, right? Like, I remember Senator mm-hmm. Kennedy is one of the voices that talked about educational equity with some of this stuff. And so the last 20 years has been marked by an increased reliance on standardized testing at the state and national level. And it feels like we're starting to move away from that, specifically in NAEP, but accountability as kind of a standardized testing infrastructure feels like it's weakening.
Mm-hmm. So one of the interesting first moves that President Trump had back in 2017 was to repeal or otherwise get rid of the nutrition guidelines for school lunch that were championed by Michelle Obama. So I think this is possibly an interesting full circle moment because now we have a Health and Human Services Secretary who has a slogan called Make America Healthy Again, which focuses partly on food and exercise. So do you think those nutrition guidelines might have a new champion in RFK Jr.?
Well, I definitely think RFK Jr. has a different view of nutrition and exercise and really unique viewpoints on health in general. Our listeners may know RFK Jr. in his hearings kind of questioned and suggested he wants to move away from requiring any vaccines. And so, you know, that has implications for schools, mm-hmm. that schools have been a mechanism for public health to say you have to have these vaccines on the schedule as a way of indicating, you know, how well or not certain communities are vaccinating their children. So that was the first thing that came to mind when you ask about nutrition and health guidelines from RFK. I would say, you know, RFK as a champion, perhaps as someone who might redefine virtually everything. When I've heard him talk about food, for example, I know he is very critical of processed food and thinks there's too much stuff in our food. Michelle Obama, as I understood it, really wanted to increase the number of vegetables and things of that nature. So I'm not sure he runs counter to that, but just based on some of his other comments, I would suggest he has really unique and specific viewpoints. I have not heard as much about his discussion on exercise other than, you know, he's now in charge of Health and Human Services and is you know, going to be asking a lot of questions, maybe similar to what we've seen in the Department of Ed in terms of, you know, redefining most everything.
Yeah. Are there any current legislative initiatives in the Congress? Has anything related to education already passed the House or Senate, for example?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think Congress and maybe some in higher education or K-12 can relate to this. My sense of Congress in both the Democratic and Republican parties, I've heard folks say they're trying to catch their breath because there's just a lot happening executively over the last month. And so one thing we haven't talked about is grants and, you know, both in education and in the National Institute of Health, a lot of what Elon Musk is doing with his group is questioning if those grants should be funded or some of the details of that grant funding. The reason I bring this up is members of Congress, when stuff like that happens, members of Congress get pinged by a lot of their constituents that are impacted by those decisions. And so I have not seen any major education legislation. I mean, I know there's a bill to eliminate the U.S. Department of Education. I think that's a placeholder bill from what I can tell. And there's some other things, but I think they're really kind of focused in on the budget right now and the reconciliation and figuring out, you know, what the tax cuts vis-a-vis spending cuts will look like, because the executive branch has just come in with a really aggressive agenda this first month and a half.
Right. And both of the last times that we talked, we mentioned the tension between the executive and legislative branches over education policy. Maybe there isn't as much at the moment because there's just not a lot of action in the legislature at the moment. But there is a third branch of our government, and that's the courts. So how likely do you think the courts are going to step in regarding the dissolution of the Department of Education or maybe some of the special education laws or anything else that might be on the chopping block?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I wonder if it's going to be policy and area specific. I think it was the Maine governor last week had an interaction with President Trump and said, you know, we'll see you in court. And so we have had some state attorneys general come together and oppose some of the things as they pertain to discrimination specifically. Because the executive branch is moving at the pace they're moving, it does feel like there's going to be a lot of legal challenges. I'm not a legal scholar, so it's hard for me to figure out which of these will kind of be thrown out and which of them will hold. My concern is what happens to programs, both on the student side and the educator side, that are in limbo, that may or may not exist, and, oh, this is going to be this huge court battle. We know that will take a long time, and there are kids. My kids this morning got up and they went to school. And so, you know, kids still need to be educated in this kind of in-between time as we figure out what's legal and what's not. And so that's my biggest concern right now. In terms of the legislative and executive tension, I think because President Trump was so successful in the campaign, my sense is many of the Republicans are hesitant to oppose his vision for anything, especially education policy. So I don't hear a ton of pushback. When they talk specific numbers about schools or universities losing X number of dollars, I think that's when people will start to shift in their seat a little bit. But right now it feels like the administration, you know, isn't afraid to threaten people in terms of, you know, what their future ability to get reelected is going to be if they come out too oppositional to what the administration is trying to do.
Right. So this is maybe a little complicated question. So listeners, hang here with us. Last time I spoke to Dr. Saltz, he pointed out that the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment was used to strengthen civil rights under Obama. Did that also happen under Biden? And how durable do you think the 14th Amendment will be for these purposes, given that there's already an attempt to eliminate birthright citizenship, which is part of that amendment?
Yeah, and, you know, my hope is the 14th Amendment will, you know, protect citizens in ways that it has historically. That really came out of the civil rights movement in acknowledgement that our country was not treating people equally, and that was problematic. To answer your question, so President Obama expanded the scope of, again, the Office of Civil Rights, or OCR, within the U.S. Department of Education. And the idea was that this was a mechanism, a place students could go if they were bullied, based on race or gender, sexual orientation. The first Trump administration rolled back some of those Biden initiatives. The Biden administration went back to kind of Obama's vision of what I consider defining discrimination. And then last week, there was something called a Dear Colleague letter that was sent to universities. And that Dear Colleague letter is best understood as redefining racial discrimination. The Dear Colleague letter, which is a letter from the executive branch, states that any kind of attempt to favor a group based on gender or race or any other kind of identity marker is actually discrimination. And so at the university level, that means some of our scholarships that are targeted to certain groups in education. Here at Pacific, we have worked to diversify our teacher workforce, for example, and I'm really proud of our efforts to have our teacher workforce better represent our student population. But this Dear Colleague letter is redefining racial discrimination. And so I would encourage our readers, the Brookings Institute has a scholar named Rachel Pereira, Dr. Rachel Pereira, who has done a lot of really good work on this. And I've personally learned from her work that has kind of tracked how this Office of Civil Rights has functioned at the national level, because it has been a legal mechanism for people to go to if K through 12 or higher education institutions are discriminating in various ways, and has been kind of an arbiter and a mechanism for people to turn to. The Trump administration is moving away from that, and actually it's going the other way to say if there are any targeted things for women or ethnic groups, for example, that is discriminating. And so discrimination in this sense is everyone has to be treated equally, and any preferential treatment on any identity marker would be considered, quote, discrimination. So I think this will all get caught up in the court, and people smarter than me will have to figure it out.
Okay. I wonder if they're going to use alumni of the same university as a marker of a group that you might belong to because your parents went to the same place. I don't know. That seems to be like a very, very big area of favoritism for anybody who's ever worked at a university. So anyway, as I asked last time, what do you think the end game is for the GOP regarding education? What, like, you know, they could project forward a couple of decades. What do they want to see?
Yeah, I think an increase in private education at the K through 12 and higher education level. I think we will continue to hear more about vouchers specifically as a mechanism for improving school quality. I think they want less programs for subpopulations. That's not just racial, ethnic groups. I think they want less programs for students living in poverty. They've been kind of clear about that. Things like Title I funding, school lunch programs. There is a strong belief that the federal government and government in general is spending too much on those subpopulations. So I think in that regard, ed policy might be thought of as a means to an end, that the goal is tax cuts and less government spending, and education is one of many areas they're looking to cut, rather than really kind of, it doesn't feel like education is the focus. It feels like the focus is on tax reform and tax cuts for very wealthy individuals in the country.
Okay. Another reintroduction. You are listening to WGTDHDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of federal education policy with expert Dr. Andrew Saltz of Pacific University is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in the discussion there. Just one more point about vouchers, and we did talk about this in one of our previous interviews, about how many students nationwide attend private schools. Has this gone up, or is it pretty steady?
It's pretty steady. I think it's around 10%. And what has increased, actually, which is really interesting since 2020, is homeschooling, kind of nationwide. We've seen homeschooling, and one theory about that is... You know, many parents were kind of tasked with homeschooling in one way or another during the pandemic. And so it might be a continuation of, you know, hey, I never thought of this. And now I kind of like it. I like spending time with my kids. And so that's my hypothesis for why. But homeschooling has increased more substantially than private schooling in general.
Mm-hmm. And then another thing that isn't always apparent for people is that despite private schooling costing money, does that filter down to the teachers? Do they make more money if they teach at a private school?
In general, no. Private school teachers in general are not unionized and have receive on average less salary and less benefits, particularly healthcare benefits and retirement benefits. The exception to that is what I would call the elite, like boarding schools. So there is a very small percentage of private schools that pay a lot. Those are kind of the most elite, highest tuition schools, mostly on the East Coast.
Right. And a lot of them don't accept vouchers of any amount. So, yeah. Okay. So one thing that has happened under the Department of Government Efficiency that we've all been hearing about is that has had an effect on education at the university level is the freezing of grants for scientific research. So can you explain a little bit about how that affects higher education?
Yeah. So our federal government funds a lot of scientific research. And in education, there's something called the Institute for Education Sciences, or IES, that has run a number of programs that has done everything from measuring school quality to a lot of teacher training grants or teacher evaluation grants. And so there have been a number of announcements saying that grant funding will be cut off, there will not be grant funding in the future, and that the current grants will be revised. And so I think big picture, there's just a lot of uncertainty. It feels like this might be another case that would get caught up in the courts, particularly for active grants. I do have a couple of colleagues who were on some review panels for the National Institute of Health. Those review panels were canceled. National Science Foundation does not have information about when grant reviews will happen or what the time frame is. And so my gut tells me that this administration is going to push for a lot less funding in grants and that moving forward, universities will really have to evaluate how they're going to make their budgets work without this. To give you an idea, we're talking about billions of dollars. The state of Oregon I saw was over $100 million just for a few institutions in federal grants. What those grants typically pay for is not just the research materials, whether it's lab or whatnot. It's a lot of faculty and staff time. And so those positions, those FTE, it's unclear what happens with that. The other component to the grant that hasn't been as publicized, but I think is important to know, universities kind of negotiate the indirect cost, which is a cost added to grants to cover things like lights and facilities, you know, other things that, you know, Pacific has to pay for me to be an employee here. And indirect cost rates usually are 30 to 60% of a grant, and that's again negotiated at the institution level. The federal government has said they want to change that to no more than 10 or 15%. And changing that overnight, again, is going to be on the order of tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars for universities to figure out, okay, we thought we were going to pay for electricity with part of this money. We now don't have that. We thought we'd pay for some of our research compliance or our IRB facilities with that money. Now we don't have that. And so part of what universities are struggling with is not just the total amount of funding for grants, but also the rules and policies and procedures associated with grants that have allowed universities to balance their budgets over time.
Right. And I, as someone who's married to a scientist, I can tell you that the instruments they use in those labs, this is not a trivial amount of electricity. You know, that sort of thing is a huge part of what they do. So, and also the, because the universities are running this, what they're basically doing is training the next generation of scientists. And not all of those scientists work at universities. Eventually they go out and work in other places and kind of do the things that we think of as, you know, just sort of part of everyday life now. I did, a few years ago, I did an interview with a scientist who explained that Wi-Fi, which we are using right now, you and I both, and maybe all the listeners too, was actually an offshoot of a program that was designed to measure black holes and was sort of discovered completely as an accident and only because that other research was existing. So this could have a big effect on sort of how life proceeds in for our everyday existence, I think. So anyway, we are both former social studies teachers. Last time you were here, you told us about a bipartisan effort to shore up civics education. Did that go anywhere?
Not really. You know, civics education has been talked about at the state level, nationally, perhaps not surprisingly. You know, we don't have a lot of bipartisan efforts these days. I think now that the Republicans have majority in both the House and the Senate, it feels like Democrats are voting against kind of anything coming from the Republican side. And unfortunately, that has been kind of how the national political situation has grown. So while I hear both sides talking about the importance of civic education, I also have not seen it prioritized to the degree that it could be, knowing that there are a lot of positive outcomes associated with civics education.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time, so I'm going to end this interview as I did the last one, and I guess the one before that, which is, so what is the role, our listeners are probably parents, grandparents, teachers, et cetera, what is their role in the future of education in schools if they really care about any of this? What should they be doing? Where are the levers that parents, grandparents, and teachers can actually make a difference?
Yeah, great question, and I thought about two big things to say with this question. The first is, at the individual level, taking time to read with a kid, if that's your child or your grandchild, if that's your neighbor, we know that one-on-one time with children, particularly elementary school children, matters a lot. And so if you want to make a difference, take time to read to a child. That matters a lot. Volunteer at your local library or local school if there isn't a child in your neighborhood or in your family unit. In terms of the future of education, I think school boards and state legislatures are going to be tasked with what do we do now? You know, I live in Oregon. Washington, D.C. seems really, really far away. And so, yes, if you feel passionate about what's going on at the federal government, contact your Congress people, your senators, and know that your school board is likely going to have a meeting in the next 2 or 3 weeks, and they are dealing with important issues about how to support our educators, about curriculum, about school calendar, and all those things matter as well. And it's always striking when I tell people that, and sometimes they'll actually reach out to their school board member, and they're like, it's amazing. They actually wanted to talk with me, and we had coffee, and we spent an hour talking about my experience and what I thought. And so I think sometimes, you know, nationally, I get that the Trump administration gets a lot of attention. This stuff matters, and I want people to pay attention and to care. Just don't forget the local and state level matter a lot, too. And my sense, particularly in Oregon, is, you know, some of the reaction to what happens federally will try and preserve some of those things. So when I think about school lunches or other things, you know, one mechanism would be, you know, stay involved in federal conversation. Another might be, are there things locally or at the state level we can do to provide food for kids that are hungry? So I just don't forget that. And, you know, do stay involved. This stuff matters. I have a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I can tell you that I think about them a lot and think about the quality of education that they're getting and just really thankful for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Andrew Saltz, for enlightening us once again on the complicated multi-level world of U.S. education policy. Thank you for your time. It's been great talking to you again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to WGTD HDFM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of federal education policy with expert Dr. Andrew Saltz is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha County ADRC operates a durable medical equipment loan and supply closet that includes nutritional supplements and incontinence products. If you're in need or would like to donate, call 262-605-6646.
I'm Gregory Berg, and on Monday's morning show here on WGTD, we're rebroadcasting a conversation from early in 2024 with Simon Schuster, talking about his illuminating portrait